himself. Cha also. Ravayasam. Advanced in age. Akalaya. Considering. Visham Patihi. King Uttanapada. Vanam. To the forest. Viratiha. Detached. Pratishtat. Departed. Vimrishan. Deliberating on. Atmanaha. Of the self. Gatim. Salvation. So translation, after considering his advanced age and deliberating on the welfare of his spiritual self, King Uttanapada detached himself from worldly affairs and entered the forest. So purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki. John, this is the sign of a Rajarshi. King Uttanapada was very opulent and was emperor of the world, and these attachments were certainly very great. Modern politicians are not as great as kings like Maharaj Uttanapada, but because they get some political power for some days, they become so much attached to their positions that they never retire unless they're removed from their posts by cruel death or killed by some opposing political party. It is within our experience that the politicians in India do not quit their positions until death. This was not the practice in olden days, as it is evident from the behavior of King Uttanapada. Immediately after installing his worthy son, Dhruva Maharaj, on the throne, he left his home and palace. There are hundreds and thousands of instances like this in which kings in their mature age would give up their kingdoms and go to the forest to practice austerity. Practice of austerity is the main business of human life. As Maharaj Dhruva practiced austerity in his early age, his father, Maharaj Uttanapada, in his old age also practiced austerity in the forest. In modern days, however, it is not possible to give up one's home and go to the forest to practice austerity. But if people of all ages would take shelter of the Krishna conscious movement and practice the simple austerities of no illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling, and no meat eating, and chant the Hare Krishna mantra regularly, 16 rounds, by this practical method, it would be a very easy task to get salvation from this material world. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 4th canto, 9th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Dhruva Maharaj Returns Home. So, Omagana Timadanda Shah Gananjana Shilakaya Chakshur Meditam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So Prabhupada, of course, is making a very indirect reference to someone known as Mahatma Gandhi here. Many of you have heard of Mahatma Gandhi? Yeah. So Mahatma Gandhi was one of the people wasn't fighting actually, he was being peaceful to try to get independence for India. And actually, Prabhupada said independence came because of the freedom fighters under Subhash Chandra Bose rather than Mahatma Gandhi, but that's another issue. So Mahatma Gandhi finally got freedom from the British for India. And when he got that, he discovered there was a problem. What was the problem? The problem was that there was this person named Jinnah and also Nehru. Little history for you. Jinnah was the head of the Muslim League, and Nehru, he was like the prime minister in India. And so they had planned to split India into three states, because there's East Pakistan, West Pakistan, which now is known as Bangladesh, and there's India itself. And so it was that plan was coming from the British, who wanted to do what we call divide and conquer. Prabhupada said that. Prabhupada said the Hindus and the Muslims were getting along pretty nicely before the independence of India, and then the British, their whole idea is, they don't want us, so we're going to destroy their whole country. So divide and conquer between the Hindus and Muslims. And many, many millions of people died as they were leaving either Pakistan, going to India, or leaving India, going to Pakistan or Bangladesh, etc. So Gandhi was really upset with this, and he was in his old age. This is what's in reference to the verse. In his old age, he was actually executing different austerities to try to get everybody. This was his standard method of trying to get everybody to work together. Austerities such as going on a long fast. And Prabhupada also in the Bhagavad Gita talks about, it's interesting, in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna talks about how one who tortures the super soul by performing austerities on the body, I'm paraphrasing, is called a demon. So Prabhupada comments in that regard that politicians who engage in fasts, it's also demoniac, in order to accomplish their political purposes. So Prabhupada was indirectly referring to Mahatma Gandhi. And then Prabhupada had many other comments about Mahatma Gandhi, saying you can't rubber stamp a Mahatma. You understand? Rubber stamp? You know, rubber stamp means you can't just give someone a label that they're a Mahatma and then consider them to be a Mahatma. That's like that story of the Wizard of Oz. Anyone's heard the story of the Wizard of Oz? Where the scarecrow, he wanted a brain or something like that, is that right? And they gave him a certificate and then he had a brain. Anyway, so Prabhupada said you can't rubber stamp a Mahatma because Mahatma nastu mam partha dharmam prakritim ashrita. Mahatma is one who takes shelter of Krishna's spiritual energy. Bhajantjananya manasho gyatva bhutanam avyam. He's always worshipping Krishna. So Mahatma Gandhi was very disappointed because of all the disturbances that were occurring in India at that time, the split of India. And he did fast and tried to get people together. Prabhupada wrote him a letter. He said, you know, now's the time to teach Bhagavad Gita. Basically, I think some of you have read that letter, right? So Prabhupada said, now is the time. You know, you've done your political stuff, and, you know, turned out to be a failure because, you know, anyway, politics, really, it's because it's in the mode of passion. Politics is in the mode of passion, friends and enemies. It's ultimately bound to meet with failure because it's not going to create good relationships with people. It's creating relationships of friends and enemies. So Prabhupada said, now's the time to teach Bhagavad Gita. And he said, if you don't teach Bhagavad Gita, you know, you don't renounce everything basically right now, all your political stuff, guess what's going to happen? You're going to meet an end like Mussolini. People read that letter? It's interesting. Prabhupada, this is like 2 or 3 weeks before Gandhi got killed. Prabhupada predicted it. He said, give it up, or you're going to be killed. Exactly what Prabhupada is talking about in the purport here. He said, give it up or you're going to be killed like Mussolini. Of course, you probably don't know who Mussolini is because all of you are too young. Anyway, he was in charge of Italy during World War II, and he died, and Hitler died, and all these so-called great politicians have died, no matter how great they are. And another thing Prabhupada said, what they do with the politicians is they erect a statue to them, like Napoleon in France, or even Joan of Arc. Anyone's heard of Joan of Arc here? In France. She was actually only, I think she was 16 or 17 years old, and she saved France from the British. Anyway, she's a great hero. So they have all these statues, and Prabhupada said that simply pigeons are passing stool. That's the puja, you know. Imagine, you know, what is the puja for your deities? Well, we have the pigeons pass stool on the deities. That's why Prabhupada said that basically we shouldn't have images of Krishna outside. Because, that, you know, obviously the pigeons. You have pigeons here? No. No pigeons in the country. Oh, I thought there's a civilized country. Oh, thank you. So anyway, so in New York we have many pigeons. Anyway, and Prabhupada said the municipal street sweeper, that means the person with the broom, he comes and he cleans off the statue once a year, and then they do the puja. In India, actually, they put garlands on the statues of their political heroes. They actually do a puja, you know, actually a real puja, you know, like some sort of dog. No, they don't chant that. But they actually do a, you know, arti ceremony to the statue. And then right after that, the pigeons go back to their business and do their puja to the statues. So that's really what Prabhupada is referring to here about his whole interaction with Mahatma Gandhi. And you can read that letter that Prabhupada wrote to Mahatma Gandhi. So, therefore, the politician is enjoined to, politician, leader, king, or whatever position you have, is enjoined to. Instead of counteracting the curse, or trying to counteract the curse of Shringi, he was the young Brahmin boy who had cursed Maharaj Pariksit. He just decided to accept that as Krishna's mercy. Also, there's the story of Maharaj Katvanga. Maharaj Katvanga was fighting for the demigods, and the demigod said, ask for a benediction, and the benediction he asked for was, tell me when I'm going to die. And they said, in a few minutes, a few seconds, whatever. He immediately took shelter of Krishna. So you have all these different examples. However, there's another point here that's not directly pointed out here, is there's something called succession. Succession is actually a very important point, especially in the Krishna conscious movement. That means, it doesn't mean necessarily success. It means arranging for someone to take over you, over after you leave. And this is a very important responsibility for kings, leaders, GBC, BBT trustees and everyone like that, is that to work on what will happen when you're no longer there. Because generally we're thinking, I know I'm thinking, I'll always be here. And that, of course, is great illusion. In the Mahabharata, King Yudhisthira is asked the question by Yamaraj, what is the greatest illusion or most wonderful thing in this world? And that is, ahani ahani bhutani gachanti yamalayam. Most wonderful things, we see everybody else dying. And what do we think? Not me. Just like in my position, I mean, I see someone dying every week. Don't see directly, but I hear about, you know, disciples die. Practically every day you hear about someone terminally ill, dying. I mean, yesterday I met a disciple here, Gokulananda, and, you know, he just had another stroke, and he's going to, you know, most likely, we're not wishing for it, but most likely he'll pass away after some time. And we don't know if we'll see him again. So, you know, I see all these things, but I'm thinking, you know, not me. I'm going to go on like this, you know, strong, young, as long as they don't put a mirror in front of me so I can see how old I am. That's why whenever I visit, you should take away all the mirrors. Anyway, so because the soul always does feel young. Prabhupada gave the example that when he was by the Yamuna River, the devotees were bathing in the Yamuna River, and Prabhupada first of all said, you know, I don't feel like going in because I'm a little old, and then Prabhupada got the enthusiasm and he went in the Yamuna, because the soul always feels young, at least when you're not identifying with the body. You always feel young. Like, you know, I feel like I'm Mathura's age. Yeah. But, you know, sometimes we act like it too, but which is not so appropriate. So the soul always feels young, and it's hard to face the fact that one day you're going to leave the body. You leave it all behind. And, you know, in Egypt, of course, they thought, you know, that they can take it all with them. You know, that's why in the pyramids they buried people with their wives, with their jewelry, with even a boat to take them across. You know, they have a boat in the pyramids to take them across the what's called the Styx River. That means, that's like the Viraja River in Egypt. You understand? The Viraja River is the river that separates the material world from the spiritual world, the causal ocean. And so they try to take it with them, but you can't take it with them. So everything you have, you're going to lose. Except for, of course, devotional service. Swapam up yasya dharmasya trayate mahatobayat, right? There's no loss or diminution, but everything else. And it's hard to face that. You know, everything you own, your mobile phone, you know, for sannyasis, it's not wives, but anyway, or family, your mobile phone, your computer, your disciples. I mean, how can I leave like that? So, it's actually quite interesting, this whole phenomena. So, before you can leave to take sannyasa or to renounce a jaya, shishi, kandarvika, girithari. So, before that, you have to make a plan for succession, otherwise it's irresponsible. It's not that you're just supposed to head for the hills and say, Prabhus, you know, you fight it out amongst yourselves. You figure it out. Succession means you train people up to take over. And that requires a little bit of detachment too. I mean, that's the beginning stage of detachment, because unless you're training, if you're not training people up, you're thinking, you know, I'm going to live forever. I'm going to be here forever. I don't want to lose control. We see this in our Krishna conscious movement, isn't it? We see that, we talked about this yesterday. Because this whole question of losing control. What if I can't control things anymore? What will happen? You know, especially in leadership. I'm just speaking for the position of leadership. Some of you are not leaders, so it may be hard for you to relate to the whole thing. But it's thinking, what if I can't control the money? I can't control the devotees? I can't control... And I can't control my body. That's even worse, you know. But guess what? Kalena sarvatra gavira ranga. So that's the time factor. It takes everything away. So either voluntary or involuntary. So even before renouncing, the point I'm making, before leaving your kingdom or whatever you're leaving, leaving your little house or whatever, you got to make plans to do it. You have to be responsible. In other words, you train people up, not just train them up, you let them gradually take responsibility, right? It's not that you go, oh, you give the training, but no hands-on training. It's all just like, what, theoretical. You just take them in the classroom and teach them. Here's what it means to be temple president. Here's what it means to be guru. Here's what it means to be sannyasi or leader. I mean, the funny thing is that in the beginning days of the movement, when all of us took responsibility, we had no training. We had to learn on the job. You know, it was interesting. You know, one day I was given sannyasa. Okay, you're a sannyasi. And he said, what am I supposed to do? Well, just don't get married. So, okay, you can do anything else? Well, that's great, you know. You can eat tons of mahaprasadam? Yeah. So later on I discovered that eating tons of mahaprasadam was not ideal for a sannyasi either, as I gained more weight. So in other words, there was no training. I mean, that's understandable because there was basically no one to train us when Prabhupada left the planet. Because Prabhupada left the planet and, you know, all of us were like roughly 21 years old or 22, whatever it was. Oh, well, I was 27. I was an old man at that point. And then all of a sudden, you know, you take sannyasa at 28. And you're a young kid, you know. Probably everybody except for Mathura is over 28 in this room, I think, pretty much. So, and you become GBC when you're 29, 30 or something like that. And you become guru when you're 33. You become absolute pure devotee. Everybody's worshiping you when you're 33 years old. I mean, wow. You got it made. Anyway, so there's absolutely no training, no experience, no hands-on, no mentorship. And that's really a disaster. And we saw that happen in the Krishna conscious movement. When Prabhupada left, you know, there was a lot of disasters and problems. We can compare that to when King Anga left his kingdom. There's an interesting story in the Bhagavatam. That once upon a time, there was a king, King Anga, and he was married to the daughter of fear personified, and he had a wonderful kid who was quite cruel, Vena. This kid was really a nice kid. I mean, he used to kill his friends when he went out to play with his friends. You know, he'd come back after playing his friends. His mother would say, "Where's your friends, Dana?" He said, "I killed them." "You better have another friend." You know, it's almost like King Henry VIII, you know. "Where's your wife, King Henry VIII?" "Well, I killed her." "You know Henry VIII? You heard of him before?" "He's the founding father of the Anglican Church." Anyway, so... so he could get a divorce. So Vena was, you know, quite an interesting chap. He killed his friend. So basically, his father, King Anga, got very frustrated with his son, as natural. And he said, "Well, this is a really bad son." But then he was thinking, "It's a really good son. Really great son." So because he's so good, so bad. Actually, nowadays, I don't know if you have this here, but in America, when you say someone's really bad, it means he's good. You ever hear that expression before? It's a common expression now. "You're really bad." "Oh, that's, thank you very much." So it means you're cool. That's an old expression. So Vena, so the King Anga, he thought, "Wow, this son is giving me an impetus to take sannyas." So he left everything, ran away. No succession for the kingdom. No planning. So at that point, Vena became the king. And, you know, if you have a king like Vena, it's more like some present political leaders in certain countries who should remain nameless to protect the innocent. Anyways, yeah, I can't mention names in class. So Vena became the king. It was torture. He was prohibiting the brahmanas from performing sacrifices. He wanted everyone to worship him as God. But he was good in one respect. He kept the criminals down. So he was actually doing a good job, in one sense. So what happened is the brahmanas understood that there had been no plan for succession. And so what the brahmanas did is they killed Vena. They had a, as they say in French, a coup d'etat. Coup d'etat means you get rid of the state, you know, you turn over your revolution. You understand? Revolution. And so they overthrew Vena, not by guns or anything, they just chanted some nice mantras, you know, "Vena die." "Vena die," broke their Brahmin threads, you know how they curse people. And Vena died, but then there was a problem. Also, there was no succession, and there was no king at all, not even a rascal king. And so all the dacoits, they started run around. And there were fires in the cities as they were burning down houses. I saw that, actually. I wasn't there at that time, but I saw that in America one time. There were riots, and there were fires going up like hundreds of meters into the air from the different riots they had because the police lost control. And so the sages, they thought, "We got to do something." So what they did is they did a cloning job. They churned, it's described, Vena's body. And out of the body, they took the bad genes. Actually, they did genetic engineering. It's interesting. This is, genetic engineering is not something new. Because in the old days, that was called eugenics, which means breeding people. Actually, that was part of Vedic society was breeding people. Did you know that? Not in a bad way, not like Hitler or anything like that. But they would make sure that the king, his son, the prince, and the king would marry the proper girl so they'd get the proper offspring. Because people had the idea that when you got married and had children, you were serving society. It's not just that, you know, you get to have some an expensive hobby by having children. Nowadays, you know, children are considered an expensive hobby. They're very expensive because they have to go to the university and everything. So anyway, so Vena, there was eugenics, the concept of breeding. Not that people were seen like guinea pigs or anything, like you just breed them in a laboratory. But marriages were arranged so that people had the proper type of children. You know, there's different concepts of marriage, prati, loma, anuloma. I'm not going to get into the details. So anyway, so Vena's body was churned. They took the genes out. in the DNA and the RNA through mantras, not through these different machines. They have this machine nowadays called CRISPR. Anyone's heard of that before? No, none of you know about science here. Your whole lives are wasted. So anyway, they have this machine called CRISPR. You can look it up on the internet. CRISPR. You'd be interested in that, Mathura. You can look it up. Google it today. And it's a machine where they can manipulate genes, you know, DNA and RNA, and give you a good nose. Not you, but, you know, give your children a good nose, a good ear, and then you get designer children. You can order your children from the DNA laboratory. Pretty good. So, no, it's demoniac. But the sages could do that through mantras. So they actually arranged the genes. They got rid of the bad genes in Vena's body. And they got the good genes, and the good genes became Prithu Maharaj. Right? You all know that story? And Archie got a man and his wife. Okay. You got the genetic engineering was so good, you got an incarnation of God. And Lakshmi. Now you can, if you can do that with genes, go ahead and use your genetic engineering if you can get an incarnation of God. So anyway, so that otherwise don't mess with it. Don't mess with cloning people. So Prithu Maharaj and Archie, they took over the kingdom, and of course everyone lived happily ever after in that particular kingdom where you have God in charge. So that's what's called succession. So devotees should be thinking like that too. Whether they're in family life or they're responsible for something in the movement, they should be thinking of the future, planning for the future. You know, we live at present. That's true. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, trust no future, however pleasant. In other words, we don't live for ourselves for something in the future, but for our responsible positions, whether you're dealing with your family, your children, you plan in the future so that they can take responsibility. Very, very important. And of course, in the Vedic system, the children took care of the parents in the future when the parents got old and couldn't take care of themselves. And that means the children have to be trained up properly. There's one story in the Jiva Dharma where the children were trained up improperly. There was a couple that trained up the children improperly. The couple was very greedy. They used to, they didn't give money to the Vaishnavas. They treated people like other people like dogs, and they saved all their money. And their children actually became the same as them. Interesting story in the Jiva Dharma. And what happened is that the children neglected the parents. The parents said, okay, whoever takes care of us the best will give all the hidden money that we have, because we have money hidden in our bedroom. You know, like they told the children where the hidden money was. And the children said, oh yes, we'll take care of you, don't worry about it. But first we want you to go on pilgrimage to Mayapur. Anyone's read the Jiva Dharma here? No. By Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So you may be familiar with this story. He said, we'll send you to Mayapur to go on pilgrimage. So they sent the parents to Mayapur to go on pilgrimage, and what did they do, the kids? They dug up all the gold. And the parents, of course, there's a happy ending because the parents realized, you know, those were not good kids, we didn't raise them in the proper way, and they took shelter in Mayapur and went back to Godhead. So there's a happy ending to the story. So the point is, there has to be some nice training of the next generation, of leaders, children, whatever it is, or else the Krishna consciousness movement will not continue. And the training means empowerment. That means giving people responsibility, stepping back, you know, stepping back from one's own power. Power corrupts, right? Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And just allowing people to make their own mistakes. And Prabhupada did the same thing before he left the planet. He empowered the devotees. Even though many of us were not qualified, he still empowered us, and that's how we develop leaders. That's why we had, amongst the Prabhupada disciples, so many leaders, because Prabhupada was concerned with succession. I mean, he didn't have enough time to do everything. He only had 11 years since he came to America. You know, he's preaching, actually started in 66, although he came to America in 65. So he had 11 years until 77. And he did what he could within that short span of time. So that's another point. And the final point is that we have to be ready, maybe not to go to the forest like King Uttanapada did, but ready just to relinquish control over things and be completely absorbed in Krishna's holy names and Krishna Katha, so that at the time of death, we can go back to Godhead. And what that absorption means, or what it externally arrangement is made, may differ according to time, place, and circumstance. Like Prabhupada said that in Bhaktivinoda Thakura, quoting from Bhaktivinoda Thakur, that the preferable stage of renunciation or sannyas in Kali Yuga is called Kshetra sannyas. Kshetra sannyas means one stays with their family but serves the deities or the movement full time in some way or other, according to their psychophysical nature. You know, whether you're talking about, you know, gardening for Krishna or deity worship or preaching, everybody has a different psychophysical nature. And Krishna says that everyone should be engaged according to their varna. So we have to understand our varna too. So proper renunciation means in Kali Yuga, very rarely should someone take sannyas. And probably no one should go to the jungle. It's not appropriate in Kali Yuga to go to the jungle. I mean, I don't know how you go to the jungle here. Isn't it sweet? Where's the jungle? I guess you go all the way to the north, you know, in the snow or something like that. And wouldn't accomplish that much, because who lives in the north here? You got Laplanders or what?
Only until November. Then after November it's...
Nobody. Isn't that like Finland? You have Laplanders up there? No.
Yes.
But it becomes so extremely cold that you anyway have to have a house and warm it. Then, like...
Really?
Survive all of the, over the winter.
You don't have any Eskimos here? In America we have Eskimos. That means they make an ice house. And they live in an ice house the whole winter. So we should start. So anyway, so that would be the sannyas here in Sweden. You just go make an ice house and chant Hare Krishna. No, I'm just joking. The real renunciation means to accept everything favorable for Krishna's service. This is what... Anukulena, and then also Pratikulena, reject everything unfavorable. You understand? That's real renunciation, real sharanagati, real surrender. Actually, we use this word surrender, but the word sharanagati or sharanam in Sanskrit doesn't really mean the same as the English word surrender. It means actually to give yourself to Krishna. To give your heart. Just like this word Shraddha in Sanskrit, which generally is translated as faith, it actually means to give your heart. Because the word in Sanskrit for heart is Shrak. So Shraddha, to give. So one gives their heart to Krishna fully, instead of being interested in Janmaishwarya Shrutasya Shibir. And the external things of this world, like King Uttanapada was when he was emperor of this world, especially his two wives, Suruchi and Suniti. So, especially Suruchi, he was interested in her, and that's why he neglected Dhruva Maharaj. So, any questions or comments? Yes, Yogendra.
Was I first?
You're older.
Thank you, Maharaj. There's many interesting points which deserve further consideration, I think. One general question.
We don't hear.
I said, thank you, Maharaj. You made many points which were worthy of further consideration.
Okay, so one point.
One point was that in general, we should make plans, I heard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Plans for our, you know, succession and for our service, continuation of our service. On the other hand, a devotee depends on Krishna and doesn't plan. Just
which devotee?
Well, it's
He who fails to plan.
I heard that Bhaktisiddhanta said that whenever there would be a plan, he would say, if Krishna wants.
Yeah, obviously. There's two things.
Can you...
Well, didn't you... In Bhagavad Gita, there's five factors of action. You know that, right?
That's what Bhagavad Gita...
You're supposed to know that. Okay, so five factors. And, you know, we have control over four of them. You know, the endeavor, the place, etc., the person. And there's only one, super soul. It's all ultimately dependent on Krishna, yes. But, you know, man, when you heard this phrase, man proposes, God disposes. Well, if you don't propose, God will dispose you. Anyway, so you have to make some endeavor. You know, otherwise... It's like you actually want to take service from God. You know, you want God to do everything for you. I mean, let's take the example of Raghunath Das Goswami. Raghunath Das Goswami was chanting on the banks of the Shyamakund, and Sanatan Goswami came upon him as he was chanting on the banks of the Shyamakund. And it was very hot out. Well, actually, the first point is there was a tiger there who was getting ready to attack him. But then there was a young boy with blue skin and a flute with a stick protecting him from the tiger. So Sanatan Goswami chastised him, you know, you got to build your own place. And Raghunath Das Goswami, well, Krishna will protect me. So he didn't take it so seriously at that point. And a few days later, Raghunath Das Goswami was chanting on the banks of the Shyamakund, and it was very hot. And Radharani was shielding him. You know the story. Radharani was shielding him with her veil. And Sanatan Goswami saw that, and he severely chastised Raghunath Das Goswami. You build yourself a kutir. That's an order. And he did. And, you know, you can say, Krishna will protect me, Krishna. Like Krishna protection. Or there's another story Prabhupada told in that regard. That once upon a time there was a guy, you know, and I'm sure most of you heard this story. Once upon a time there was a guy who had complete faith in God, that he was always going to protect it, and he was living in his house, and there was a flood. You heard the story. And the water was rising, you know, a big, big flood, and a boat came by and said, jump in the boat. And the guy said, no, God is protecting me. And the water rose higher and higher and higher and higher, and the guy was up on his roof trying to escape, and then they sent a helicopter. And then they lowered a rope, and they said to the guy, grab onto the rope, and the guy said, no, I have faith in God. God is protecting me. So then, what happened is he died. He drowned. He went to God, Krishna, whoever. He went to Krishna, and he said, Krishna, you were supposed to protect me. And Krishna said, you jackass, you fool. Didn't you see the boat and the helicopter that I sent? So, you know, you have to use your own brain in these things. And, you know, there's this common saying, he who fails to plan, plans to fail. You know, it's not, this is almost like a hippie consciousness that, you know, that do your own thing, you know, God will take care of everything, you don't have to worry about anything. And it ends up in a disaster. Ends up in a disaster because... I mean, God could do everything. That's true. I mean, he's God. But he wants you to raise your hand, you know, to do something. Isn't it?
A specific instance of this decision here. You said that in the Vedic culture, the children are trained by the parents that take care of the children when they take care of the parents, rather, when the parents get too old to take care of themselves. Everybody needs help in the end.
Yeah.
On the other hand, in regard to Dhritarashtra, it's said that if you leave home and die in a faraway place and your family have no knowledge of it, that's a glorious death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in his particular instance, first of all, he was taken care of. Vidura went with him. If you read the story, Vidura went with Dhritarashtra and Gandhari to take care of them. It's not that he was just like sent off into the forest, you know, by himself, a blind man, and his wife had her eyes tied. That's the first point. And secondly, Dhritarashtra was not specifically living with, let's say, his direct family. His kids have been killed. And he was living with people who were taunting him. This is described in the Mahabharata, that Bhimsen, who had killed all the children of Dhritarashtra, was continually slapping his muscles like this and saying, "With these muscles, I killed your kids." And Dhritarashtra could hear that all the time. And he was living like a household dog there with people who were not, you know, of course, Yudhisthira was helping him a lot, and the other Kapandavas too. But he needed to detach himself from this world. And so it's a little bit different with Vaishnava families. And one has a Vaishnava family, you know, the children are Vaishnavas, hopefully, then they'll remind one of Krishna and take care of one. So, and it's a different age, you know, you're talking about the Dwarpa Yuga versus the Kali Yuga. I mean, this, you're talking about Kshatriyas versus all of us who are mixed races of unknown origin, as Prabhupada said. So, it's a little, you know, the scenario is not the same. So the implicit question that you're actually asking is, so how to, let's say, raise the children so they want to take care of the parents when they get older? I mean, that's a big question. What we do see generally is that the children in the modern world, actually nowadays the parents don't even get married, what to speak of, isn't it? I heard Sweden is like one of the tops of the charts with people not getting married, right? So, I mean, that means, it means no commitments are not there. So people can just drop off someone, you know, just go for a new so-called lover or whatever. And so, how to raise the children or encourage them to take care of the parents, there has to be a loving relationship. In other words, there has to be, or it's a reciprocation of love. It's not a question that the children are forced to do it. They have to want to do it. You understand? And if the children experience a traumatic childhood, they're not going to want to do it. But if the children experience Krishna consciousness as something very loving, something very positive, and they love their parents, they're going to naturally want to take care of their parents. I mean, even with my mother, I had a very nice relationship with my mother. I still do, actually. She's still alive. She's only 91. So I offered my mother, you know, I'll take care of you. Make sure you chant your rounds. But she's too attached to her independence. She still drives and swims and everything like that. So she won't give in. But I'm willing because I care for her. She was very loving with me. She struggled to do everything for me. And it was, you know, if the relationship is there, the children will be happy to do it, isn't it? That's the whole point. It's not simply imposed upon the children. It has to come from the heart. Yes. So,
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. I think Srini has a question. Yeah.
I said, how we, if we do service to the others, and when the children see, then they follow the footsteps of the parents.
Yes. Yeah, the parents have to be good examples.
You have to show your own example.
Yeah, that's true. And the parents have to be very loving, too. Because if the parents... Yeah, if the parents are very loving and serve their parents, then... You know, that's a good example for the children. Anyway, so it's important. It's important because I don't expect anybody just to head for the hills when they get older. You know, you need some old age insurance. And the old age insurance should be the family. And, of course, the family of devotees, too. You know, I've made arrangements sometimes to take care of different devotees when they're getting old. One of my godbrothers, who I mentioned to the devotees yesterday, he's passed away, but he had Parkinson's disease, and his family put him in a government home, and it was terrible. He was in one of these government homes, you know, for people who are disabled, Parkinson's disease, because his wife couldn't take care of him. So in this home, you know, you walk into the home, the whole place smells like urine, basically. And he was in a room with someone, he couldn't chant, couldn't listen to Krishna, anything to do with Krishna, because the person in the room was, you know, wasn't favorable to Krishna consciousness. So his family wasn't taking care of him. So I just, like, stepped into the whole scene and told the devotees and his wife, he's got to go to India. And so what happened is initially the wife was opposed because, you know, she had him in a comfortable place where he was taken care of. You know, like sometimes nowadays you want to just warehouse someone. Just put them and not think of them. You know, visit them once a week or once a month so you don't feel guilty about the whole thing. Isn't it? I mean, that's what people commonly do in old people's homes. So, but I just didn't accept that. Even though, you know, he wasn't my blood relative, but he was my godbrother. So I just kept insisting. Finally, they agreed. And they sent him to India. And they put him up in the Vaishnava hospice in Vrindavan. And 3 months later, he passed away. So by my pushing for this, he was able to pass away in the Association of Devotees, hearing the holy name. Otherwise, it would have been a disaster passing away in such a place. And, you know, devotees really have to care for each other. And I have another god sister who passed away in an old people's home in Canada. Some of you may know Padyavali. Anyone? Maybe you don't know her. Anyway, she's a Canadian devotee. And she served the mission for many years, and she was just in an old people's home without association. So we have to take care of the old people. I mean, part of Vedic culture, a very important part of Vedic culture, is taking care of the cows, the Brahmins, the old people and women. If these are neglected, these four classes of people, or entities, because cows too, are not people per se, then you have no culture. There's no culture. Society is just hopeless. So, is that right?
I don't want to speak out of turn, but it just comes to mind our god sister, Isha.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know her departure.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so the devotees should just get together and help the devotees who are older, the devotees who are passing away, so they can pass away in the Association of Devotees, or at least be taking the final few years, be reminded of Krishna. Isn't it? I mean, it's so important. I mean, when I get ready to leave my body, which will be never, because I'm an illusion. So when I get back ready, I mean, I just want to be with devotees. I don't want to see anyone else other than devotees, unless I can preach to someone. Because I just want to remember Krishna. So, any other questions or comments about these things? Yes. Whoops.
We had a few weeks, or maybe a month ago, we had a seminar in Alvik about the hospice care and how to care for departing Vaishnavas. And one thing they mentioned is that the most terrible place to leave the body for a Vaishnava, for devotee, is a hospital.
Yeah.
Can you?
Yeah, well, hospital. Yeah, I mean, obvious, because they won't even let people be there. If you're in the intensive care unit in the hospital, then basically you're only allowed to go in like an hour a day to see the person like that. So that's the most terrible place. However, let's talk about a hospice. You know, there are hospices that allow the devotees. We had a devotee pass away in North Carolina, and it was in a professional hospice because devotees couldn't care on that level. But we had they allowed a devotee to be with him 24 hours a day. In that case, it's not necessarily a bad thing. We had devotees. I went there, you know, played my guitar for him. And we all took turns, and there was someone with him, at least one person, two, three, sometimes five people with him 24 hours a day. So in that case, it's not such a bad thing. But if it's in a controlled hospital, then it's very bad because you can't be with the person. I mean, another time one of my godbrothers was in the hospital, his intensive care unit, and I went in, you know, I told him I was a minister. I guess I am. So they let me in, and his family was there too. But his family, they weren't like so Krishna conscious, and they were just calling him by his legal name. You know, John. And I was watching the monitors above his head, you know, the heart and the oxygenation and all that other stuff. And I was saying, if he flatlines, you know, anyone know what flatlining means? That means all that stuff. So I'm kicking these ladies out of here. And I'm just chanting for them. So So basically, sometimes a hospice is a good situation because there are certain needs that a person may need a nurse 24 hours a day. But if the devotees can be there 24 hours, it's fine. And you have someone else taking care of the bodily necessities, because there are bodily necessities. I've been with a lot of devotees as they passed away. One of the devotees, Lochan, who is the one who makes all the he didn't pass away, of course, but his daughter, who makes all the Prabhupada Murtis, maybe some of you know Lochan Peru, and his famous devotee, and his daughter had terminal cancer. So I arranged that I was there every day reading for her, and I even brought my Giriraj, my Shilas, with me for her, and helped her leave the body, go through the various stages. Because if you're trained up in terminal care for people, which the devotees should be trained up, there's different stages that people go through. And, you know, the final stage is just like saying, you know, fighting against it. I'm not going to die. And then what you have to do is say, what I do is say, there's something better on the other side for you. You just relax. And after I said that to her, she left her body. And anyway, it's part of life. Actually, it's part of my service that I'm with devotees when they leave their bodies. Of course, I don't cause the devotees to leave their bodies. Hopefully not. So that would be very bad. It would be like the Grim Reaper, you know, whatever. So, it's very important to take care of Vaishnavas. Actually, Vaishnava Seva is one of the important principles of devotional service. And if we can't do it, we're not even cultured what to speak of devotees, right? So, I think we have to end now, because part of Vaishnava Seva is prasadam, right? Prasadam Seva. Okay, thank you very much. All glories to His Divine Grace. Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada.